You're listening to Randall Wallace Presents, formerly Bridging the Political Gap, the number one American history podcast of 2024 by Feedspot.com.
School in Loris and lifeguarding here in Myrtle Beach and in North Myrtle Beach or Ocean Drive at that time every year. Mm-hmm. So I'd say at times I'm original son of the beach. Mm-hmm. That there aren't a lot of them down here now, but those of us that have seen the things go that have gone magnificent, what has happened in the last 5 years, and I predict the next 5 years are going to be just as rapid growth, and probably even more. Foreign countries are discovering Myrtle Beach. It's going to be in Oree County. It's going to be the entire of Oree County in a few years will be a suburb of two working areas, I think, and we've just got great growth before us. Look, television stations here that now used to be Wilmington, Myrtle Beach, or Florence, Myrtle Beach. Now it's Myrtle Beach, Florence, or Myrtle Beach, Wilmington.
You're exactly right.
So it's changing. The numbers are there. The people are coming. Nature has given us a great playground. It's given us some responsible leaders. So I think it's a great place to live. It's a great place to grow, to raise children. Mm-hmm. And it's a great place to seek employment and work and mm-hmm. be a part of a community. I'm happy and delighted to have been a part of that.
Welcome to this episode of John Jenrette, and this is going to be an interesting one where he takes off from Loris into what can only be described as a fascinating early adulthood in Myrtle Beach, in Wofford College, and then off to Yellowstone, back to the military, and then back here to Oree County, where he'll begin his political career. So it's a circle of his early adulthood that is just fascinating to listen to.
Off to college, right? You were living in Loris when you went off to college.
I was living in Loris when I went to college, and yes, I went to Wofford College. I was had a scholarship, football scholarship, to Wofford College from my last year in Loris.
Where do thoughts lead? Come on, let's find out. Wofford College is a place where thought leads, where ideas are celebrated and problem-solving is expected.
Wofford is committed to preparing thought leaders who are adaptable and responsive to a rapidly changing world.
Our students are so bright and so interested in learning about the world. They know they can make a difference, and they know Wofford will give them the opportunities to do just that.
You'll also be supported every step of the way.
As the first in my family to go to college, I would need a support system. And I was so grateful to find organizations full of students and staff who have assisted me along my journey.
When I was making my decision to go play college football,
ready, break!
I chose Wofford because I knew I wasn't settling for just athletics or academics.
I'm also getting a world-class education that will prepare me for life after college.
I've made the decision to major in English and Spanish, launch my own business, and work as a marketing intern. I don't know what's next for me, but I know that I'll be ready because of my 4 years at Wofford.
That's what it means to go to a college where thought leads.
That's what it means to make the decision to become a Wofford Terrier.
And then what did you study at Wofford? What was your major? Were you in the politics back then?
No, I was in, I wanted to be a journalist at the time, and but when I went, I was in athletics. Most of my things in Loris was football, baseball, and just a little bit of other activities. And so I thought more about when I thought I had a football scholarship, I went by whatever they asked me to do, the football team. Being at Wofford College and It's been a wonderful event, even though I didn't make the team or anything.
But you stayed the 4 years and graduated.
I stayed the 4 years, and they called me and gave me the scholarship or opportunity, the scholarship, and I didn't make the team, and I did do some workouts, and my first pass was thrown to Jerry Richardson, if you remember who that gentleman is. He just sold his football team last month, I think, for $2 billion.
Was he at Wofford also?
Oh, yeah. He was my roommate. We were roommates. We've been friends for many, many years. His daddy was a barber, and my daddy was a carpenter, and neither one of us had anything. And we got together there, and we've just had a great, great life. And he's had some problems, and his wife had some problems. It was great, and he was a great football player. When they took me out of my scholarship, I did laundry and worked in the kitchen. And they finally came back and said, "We will give you a half scholarship back if you'll do one thing for us." And I said, "Coach, what is that?" I said, "Will you be the quarterback? You will be the quarterback for the opposing team." And I said yes, and I hurt to this day. I mean, those boys beat me up like everything. And right now, I'm in a stern thing right now, trying to get my shoulders better. But that they beat me to death. But I had to. I mean, I'm poor. I had to do it.
That's how I got out.
And I was lucky because when I first went in, I had one of the seats in this. Where we slept and all together, and Jerry was there, so we had a small room rather than a group of people. So we had a really nice time, and it was one that really after 10 o'clock, after they came and checked, if you wanted to slip out, you could. Now we didn't do that, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure.
As soon as I could get a chance, I hit the beach. I mean, I became a lifeguard, and since then I've always been known as a son of the beach. And so I've loved it, and I started doing much better in business on the ocean front than I did before. But I'd have to go back to Lawrence every weekend. But in the summers, I was there 4 years. I was on the beach, and I would come back to Lawrence. So I wouldn't come by. I would live at the beach for the summer, and then I would came back to.
Your family was still in Lawrence.
Yes, the family was still
but
in Lawrence.
You spent your college summers at the beach.
Yes.
Are we talking about North Myrtle Beach or Myrtle?
No, this. Well, it's
Cherry Grove.
It's called Ocean Drive. It's where I was a lifeguard, and I enjoyed it. Because of the changing of everything, and the most thing you enjoyed about in those ages was that pretty girls came down. Some wealthy men came down, and they would come, and we guys didn't know hardly what to do, but we were trying to learn, and I decided that one of my favorite things, I had a really nice plate, a really nice stand, and these pretty girls, gosh, they would come in, they're so pretty, and the fathers and the mothers both would come out and smoking cigarettes were big back then. And so I said, I got to do something. So I learned how to teach him how to, my father, about how to strike a cigarette in the wind, on the ocean front. So I was doing that so I'd see that little daughter of his. And he would come. He'd thank me so much about that. And then I taught myself how to open a newspaper and turn it to the other page. And I taught them how to do that with the wind.
With the wind blowing.
So I had two ways to work on that. But that was a fun time as a lifeguard.
Now we're talking pre-Hurricane Hazel, right?
Just pre-Hurricane Hazel.
We'll get Hazel, no
problem. Yeah, man.
So you're spending your summers at Ocean Drive,
yeah.
But going to Wofford.
Where I lived at the beach. I worked in a, at night I would work in a, as a busboy in a Hoskins restaurant, which is there now. And at, after that, Dew Company, which was a hardware company and a refrigerator and all like that, they let me in their building, and I slept on the refrigerator every night.
On top of the
refrigerator. And, you know, you come back late in the afternoon, they sold the refrigerator. What are you going to do? They'd have me another one, but that was a fun thing, too. You know, I didn't have much money to pay. I could save all the money. And I'd never forget that, because it was always fun about that. And the pretty girls was, I learned how to do that, and I became a, I learned the shag dance.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, because those of us that are from here know about, you know, the beach music.
Yeah.
We know our version of beach music. And you were, I guess that was some of the early days of the beach music.
Yeah, it was. And we
were, some of the old nightclubs I hear about, were they in that area that you would go to?
No, we had the shag dance was, it was created there, and it was done on a place called shag dance was, my lord, the
Was it the Galleon?
Galleon,
yeah. Was that the original one?
Galleon, that's where they had it. And we had the people that had houses right in back of the Galleon. And so we, a lot of entertainers would come there as we got going. And it was a really a nice thing. And everybody that worked on the beach, like me, was there. And I got to be a pretty good dancer. And so the owner did a little dance step upstairs. They called Johnny's at the beach.
Is that named after you?
Yeah, it named after me. And that's why I could get there. Only the best dancers could go up there. If you didn't know how to dance.
Shag.
And I said, we're really pretty. I'd let one come in. But other than that, it was a shag dancing, because that was a hot thing, because everybody else would leave. Well, I want to go up there. That was just something. I don't know how I got it, but I did. And it was
down here at Atlantic Beach and north at what's now North Norwood Beach, Ocean Drive back then. The man who owned the Atlantic Beach Pavilion had the jukebox concessions all up and down the Grand Strand. So every week he had to buy two sets of records. He got most of his records from the distributor in Florence, but the records for the Atlantic Beach jukebox he had to order out of South Philadelphia, because back then in the late 40s and early 50s, they didn't sell race music in the music stores and they didn't play it on the radios. As he took records off the Atlantic Beach jukebox, he started using them as fill-ins on all the other jukeboxes. We started dancing to rhythm and blues, black rhythm and blues, and it became known as beach music because the only place you could hear it was on the jukeboxes at the beach. And back then, the Myrtle Beach closed at midnight. And so at midnight, everybody would pile into Atlantic Beach like a big street party, because that's where all the entertainers went after they finished their shows. We took that real fast jitterbug four-beat dance and added two steps to the back of the basic, which slowed it back down to like the original Lindy Hop. The music always brings people together, and down here, it very much brought people together. And back then, it just really didn't matter. We were all there for the music. And it didn't matter whether you were black or white, that was irrelevant. All we cared about was the music. And we danced with the black girls danced with the white guys. It wasn't a big deal. It wasn't a big deal at all to us. It was just dancing to the music. I've been teaching at Fat Harold's and working at Fat Harold's for 35 years. Over those years, the dance got more and more popular, because over the last 20 years or so, it spread all across the country.
Charlie and Sarah opened Charlie's Place as a supper club in 1937. It was a stop on the Chitlin Circuit, nightclubs where black entertainers such as Billie Holiday, the Mills Brothers, Little Richard, Ruth Brown, Otis Redding, and the Drifters performed during the era of racial segregation. While the club is gone, Fitzgerald Motel, built in 1948, remains. The motel served black entertainers and travelers who could not stay in whites-only hotels. oral tradition holds that the shag, a form of Southern swing dancing, originated here. Both white and black customers gathered here to listen to music and dance. In 1950, the Ku Klux Klan led a parade through The Hill, the African-American neighborhood where Charlie's Place was located. The Klan returned later, and shots were fired into the club, injuring many. Charlie was severely beaten but survived. Some Klansmen were charged, but no one was prosecuted.
It seems like everybody either played, stayed, or parties at Charlie's Place.
Charlie's Place was a regular stop on the Chitlin circuit of black nightclubs in the South. All the great R&B musicians played there. White kids were crazy for black music and dance, and Charlie Fitzgerald welcomed them to his club.
Well, now, how about the groups that would come, the musical groups to play? Do you remember of any of those names?
Oh,
what were some of the ones?
Yeah, a lot of.
Was that the days before the Tams and the Drifters, or was that?
They were there, and I've got all, and I've got several photographs of those people that I'll share. But it was a really an interesting thing, and the thing about it is that. A mile away was a black community.
What was the name of that community? Was that over on 90?
No, it was right on the beach.
I know what you're talking about. Atlantic Beach.
Atlantic Beach, gosh. Atlantic Beach, yeah. And so the musicians had to stay there. On the beach.
At Atlantic Beach.
Yeah, that was still a thing that they didn't do. So they would come in and play for us at night, and about 11 or 12 o'clock, they would go and play again for their friends and all that were there. So all they did was play music back and forth, because you couldn't get them up till 12 o'clock the next day, no matter what you did.
Yeah. But you just got in bed.
And they were very good, very nice, and very good. And we had, it started us in some extra music, because they would bring people. And my little business would triple what my little group was, because at that time they would come up and dance, and nobody bothered them that they were there dancing. They were not dancing with they were dancing with their community group, not others that were there. So it was always good, and they were, if they liked you and they played really good music, and it got us all going, and it started people coming to for music and understanding it. And
did you ever venture down into Myrtle Beach?
In fact, I my first job as a lifeguard, I had offered to go to Myrtle Beach, and I don't recall it particularly why, but I got a job, and this was after I'd forgotten this. My first job as a when I first got from in out of Lawrence with other people, I went there was a major horse race track in Myrtle Beach,
Washington Park,
and they would bring Yawkey and that crowd that we were talking about earlier. They would bring their horses from New York and places and put them in Myrtle Beach, And now it was a great thing doing, but when Yawkey and them got out, it fell. But it was one of my very first jobs, because I was picked up manure. That was my manure, picking up manure, and the person that helped me with that was one of the tobacco market people that had money, and he had a son, and so the two of us, he got a job for his son and me, picking up manure on Saturday afternoons at the racetrack. And that was before we were young enough to know that you're not supposed to pick up manure.
That was still back when you were in high school.
Yeah,
back in those days.
That was an interesting thing on the
This is Randall Wallace, your host for Bridging the Political Gap. I want to thank you first for tuning in to our podcast and invite you to come to our website, randallwallace.com. There you can get a copy of our book, Always Vote Your Conscience, Don't Take It Personally, and Don't Fight the Same Old Battles Over and Over Again, with a lot of policy suggestions and things that I think everyone could embrace, an argument for why we need to be working together instead of fighting with each other. Also, you can take a look at the first 11 episodes of this podcast, which was a podcast documentary that looked at the World War II generation of bipartisan leadership that built the American century and the lessons we can learn from them to apply to today's situations. Again, thanks for tuning in to our podcast. And if you've enjoyed our show, please leave us a review at wherever you get your podcast. And now, let's get back to the show.
Yellowstone National Park stretches across the northwest corner of Wyoming, reaching into Idaho and Montana. Founded in 1872, Yellowstone was the world's first national park and now hosts over 4 million adventurers every year. A 12-hour drive from Seattle or a 5-hour drive from Salt Lake City, there's no doubt that it's a trek to get here. But the moment you step foot in this vast park, you'll know it was worth every mile. With endless green prairies, spectacular mountain ranges, and abundant wildlife, Yellowstone is the very best of North American wilderness, wrapped up into a 2-million-acre gift for nature lovers. Yellowstone is proudly managed by the National Park Service, and its highlights are easily accessible by the Loop Road, which can be reached from each of the park's 5 entrances. So buckle up and get ready to explore a land untouched by humanity. Yellowstone is a geothermal extravaganza that sits atop a slumbering supervolcano, which is said to have violently erupted over 60,000 years ago. Geologists have long debated the caldera's origins, and theories abound as to when the next big eruption is due. But don't let the merchants of doom put you off. Seismic activity is closely monitored to ensure the safety of park visitors.
I think it's somehow noble and visionary to protect this wildness for future generations. And so we really, in my opinion, need to struggle and strive to protect places like Yellowstone. Lodge at Old Faithful, which everybody calls the Lodge, is really Old Faithful Inn. And the Lodge, Old Faithful Lodge, is a separate building. Old Faithful Inn was not the first building to be built. It didn't come along until 1904. Hotels, but by 1887, Yellowstone had 8 hotels. Now, some of them were rustic, not, you know, what many of us would call hotels. You know, you furnished your own bedding, you were treated to very primitive meals and primitive conditions, but some of them became grand hotels, such as the Lake Hotel and the Fountain Hotel that opened in 1891, the Canyon Hotel in 1890. Those were big hotels. Yellowstone was a place that imitated the great resorts such as Saratoga Springs from back east, because that was what the travelers of the 1880s expected.
What I was looking for was learning about the world a little bit. So I decided that when I finished Walford, scraping by to get through, I said I was going to hitchhike to California, a friend of mine and I, California, stop on the way, no hurry, and come back through again. Well, at the time that my friend that was going, he didn't finish school. Couldn't get out, so he had to stay. So I jumped in a car with three Walford guys who had been working at Yellowstone National Park the year before.
And in what year are we kind of talking about? It was about the 55 or something?
I think that was the first. But anyway, we started to go to Yellowstone National Park, and somebody said you ought to stop by Las Vegas. We could have got gas somewhere else, but we ended up in Las Vegas, and we didn't have any gas money after that. But anyway, we finally got to Yellowstone, and my three members who had been there, they were waiters and yard people. And so they said, well, John, you can get a, we didn't have money because we spent it, Vegas had it. So they said, John said, we'll get you a job here, like for us. So we went in to Central there where they were supposed to come in and tell them they were there ready for work. And I went in and filled out an application. And I'll be a busboy or I'll be a yard man. And looked at me and said, I filled out a paper and everything, said, we don't have any jobs. And my three friends came over, no jobs for, like, no, we got a thousand boys, and y'all are the last ones, and we don't need anybody else. And so they picked up a little bit, I think they gave me $40 to wait on the bus. And so this was just before about lunchtime, and the guy had a telephone. I was sitting waiting for the bus to come, and the telephone rang. You know, that's all we had, big old telephones. You know, you could hear them all over the track. And the guy, George, that had been the bartender, I heard him say, George had a heart attack. What in the world are we going to do? We got to say, everything's going along. We got to have somebody. What's going to happen? So I was sitting there waiting, and he said, well, I'm going to go to lunch. You got this, thing. So when he got to lunch, I went over there, and I got me out a paper. I filled out I wanted a bartender job. And I got it immediately because they're having people open it up the next day. Now, I can't tell you that I didn't understand a little bit about that, but I didn't know what I was getting into. So they said, there's 1,000 men, young men, and 500 young ladies that are the cadre for Yellowstone National Park. And they ate it in a dormitory and slept in a dormitory-like thing. The bartender, he had a private room. He ate off the menu. And he, from his room, he could see
the fountain flowing in the Yellowstone National Park, and I happened to have that room. And they said, John said, Frank, the manager will be calling on you to get to know him. And so, and this was a quick story because nobody likes it but me. But anyway, he said, get some rest, and they'll call you. The barber, the head man, will call you and introduce yourself and all to him. And so, I sat down. I went to sleep because he was tired and everything. And all of a sudden, my little telephone rang. The one same phone, but things come. He said, "Your name, John?" Yes, I said. Well, say, come up. So I'm the manager. Come up and introduce yourself and let's talk. So, Walford College. I'm walking out the door. I had a jacket on from Walford, and I had a golf tee in my pocket. Nothing, no reason. Just had it in there. I got up there and I decided to knock on his door, and I knocked it on with the golf. And he opened the door. And he said, "Are you a golfer? Man, that's great. That's great. I love golfing. Well, I played, but I wasn't worth the darn in Walford or either playing golf. But so he took me. We went in. We started talking and everything and about schooling and where I went to school and all that kind of stuff. And that he was so happy that I was there at the time needed. He said, "I didn't like that old guy anyway." Said he just would not pay attention to me. Said I didn't like him at all. Said I'm glad you're here. And Mr. Key said, "Go set up the bar."
You know what to do?
Set up the bar. So listen, let me tell you, here's a story. And I told him that story, and he laughed and everything because he was kind of happy when they got, when he saw the tap. Yeah, he'd probably kick me out if that hadn't been there. But he started talking. He said, "John," said, "I tell you what, I like you. I didn't like that other guy." I said, "If you will pay attention to me, in 2 weeks you will have learned every drink in the book." And I did. He taught me every day, every night, what to do until Desi Arnaz and Lucille Ball came in.
Wow.
They came in and he said, "John, you know who that is?" I said, "No, son, I know who that is." He said, "Don't you listen to radio?" I said, "Well, I didn't listen to anybody else on radio that I know of. That's Lucille Ball." I said, "Desi Arnaz." I said, "Desi Arnaz, you know how I love it." Anyway, but man, and so he said, "Wait on him." So I go over there and I fix my nice shirt on and everything, go over there and introduce myself and my side. He said, "You're Southern." Everything, so you're from South. He knew that. We talked about that, laughed, and he'd had a couple of drinks. And he looked up and he said, "John, fix me a drink." I said, "Yes, sir. What would you like?" "I want a Puss Cafe."
Did you know what that was?
I didn't know which either one of them was. The Puss or the Cafe. But what happened, that was one of his favorite drinks. And Lucy, they were doing it. And my guy was sitting back there laughing like the devil because he knew what I was in.
Yeah.
And so we got to be, that night, we got to be friends. I blew money on about 4 Puss Cafes before I got it right. But Puss Cafe, if anybody ever cares about it, it's a small little cylinder sack thing. I've got the wording right. But anyway, and you put in 5 different colors. But it's the coloring of the alcohol part there. It's green, red, and all that stuff. And what you do on that very little container, you take the back of a spoon, a very small spoon, and you very slowly, the heaviest weight alcohol that you're serving, you put that on the spoon, and you let it slide down to the bottom of that little piece of glass that's there. Then you wait till it cools down and sits down. Then you get another, if it's green at the bottom and it's green and it was red or green or blue or whatever the colors are that you got, and there were about 8 or 10 of the liquors. That was a word I missed, liquors. And they were all of them had these colors. So the second one, in weight, you would put it, slide it over and everything, and it could be blue or orange or anything, but you get to get five of them, and it's a pretty thing.
So it's layers of different colors.
Different, yeah. And it was beautiful, and it was, aroma was great, and the smiles on everybody in the house was great.
Did
even me. I was... That, I smiled. And that damn dead John, you know, there, he said, John, good. Picked up the whole damn thing in one drink after I'd worked, if I'd worked for an hour on getting that thing. He did it loud. John, you see, I know how to do it.
Did Lucille Ball get the same thing?
She did. You know, she didn't throw it up. She was nice. She said, you shouldn't have done that. He worked so hard. He worked so hard. Well, give him some extra money. I smile. Sure, I smile for 30 minutes.
Well, that's a great experience.
They call me Cuban Pete. I'm the king of the rumba beat. When I play the maracas, I go chick chicky boom, chick chicky boom. Yes, sir, I'm Cuban Pete. I'm the craze of my native street. When I start to dance, everything goes chick, chicky, boom, chick, chicky. The señoritas, they sing, and how they swing with this room barrel. It's very nice, so full of spice. And when they're dancing, they bring a happy ring, a very carol, singing a song all the day long. So if you like the beat, take a lesson from Cuban Pete. And I'll teach you to chick 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 boom, chick chick boom, chick chick boom. Si, señorita, I know that you will like a chick boom chick. Cause it's the dance of Latin romance. And Cuban Pete doesn't beat you in a hurry like Castle Mary. I come from Havana, and there's always mañana. So, señorita,
excuse me, Mr. Pete.
Yes, ma'am.
Have the Cubans a different beat? If they have, will you teach me to chick, chick, chicky boom, chick, chicky boom?
Si, señorita, I know that you will like the chicky boom chick.
Yeah, ma'am.
It's very nice, so full of spice. I place my hand on your hip, and if you will just give me your hand, then we shall try. Yes, you and I.
My mom was a working mom, and she went to see, I was born 6 weeks before a big show called I Love Lucy went on the air. And she was starring in that, along with my father, of all people, who also was producing it. And so they were very busy. So I think from probably, you know, the age of birth up through seven, they weren't home a lot, I would say, probably, you know, very late at night and weekends. And then we were fortunate to have some hiatus times, weekends off, and summers. Summers off when we had a house in Del Mar. And so, but she was a working mom. And when she was home, she was very businesslike about running her house. I think because she was a working mom in the 50s, there probably was a lot of guilt involved in not being home with the kids because, right, you know, you're supposed to be, I guess. And she played a very funny person in her show, very crazy, outrageous person, and all. My friends used to think that my mother was really like that, but at home, of course, she wasn't like that at all. She was very responsible, took care of business. She worried a lot about her household, you know, and how the kids were being taken care of and whether the garage was being cleaned out and the homework was being done. And she fashioned herself as a homemaker of sorts, like really enjoyed when she could get in the kitchen and make chicken and dumplings or something, but there wasn't a whole lot of time for that. So, but that was my earliest memory of my mother, was that she worked. My mother got into show business when she was very young. She left Jamestown, New York, where she was born, and she went to New York City, and she tried to take acting lessons, and they sent her home. They said she had no talent, and her mother was wasting her money. And she stayed in Jamestown a few more years and did little plays here and there. But she was always acting out, always pretending, always putting on little plays in the backyard, much like me when I was a kid, actually. And eventually her mother said, oh, go on. You know you want to be in New York. Go back. And she helped her. She paid her way, and she became a model in New York. And one day, after being a very good model for Hattie Carnegie and others, she got a great break, and she took the place of somebody on the way to Hollywood whose mother wouldn't let them go to Hollywood, and she went with the Goldwyn girls and made a movie called Roman Scandals with Eddie Cantor, and she was only out of work 24 hours the rest of her life. My dad was born in Santiago, Cuba, in 1917, and his father was the mayor of the town. His uncle was the chief of police. You know, his mother's family were the early founders of the Bacardi Rum Company, so he said they had that town pretty well wrapped up, he said, you know. But then this big revolution came, not the Castro Revolution, but the Batista Revolution came in and overthrew the Machado administration, which his father was in, and they lost everything. They lost their homes. Their livestock was killed. Their pets were slaughtered. They crushed and burned the piano and all the family photos. And his mother, hid with relatives. And my dad and his father escaped with nothing to Miami, where they had to start over again, basically, from scratch. And he lived in Miami in a warehouse with Grandpa, and he killed rats with a bat, he said. It was rough. And he cleaned canary cages there for a while for a living. And then eventually Grandpa said, okay, I know you play the guitar, and I wanted you to be a doctor, a lawyer, somebody who could, you know, fend for himself, but I guess you're going to have to go get a job as a musician. So Dad got a musician's job in a little band, and eventually was discovered by Xavier Cugat and flown to New York. And then he left Coogie and got a small band of his own down in Miami, and actually introduced the conga dance to the United States out of desperation one night. And that really was his ticket. He became quite famous for that, and playing the conga drum and doing this conga dance and the conga line. And then he went back to New York. They named a club La Conga after him. And he was playing at La Conga in New York when Rodgers and Hart discovered him and George Abbott, and asked him to be in a Broadway show called Too Many Girls, which ended up being the story of his life, I think, later on. And it opened at the Imperial Theater in New York on October, I don't remember when, I can't remember when it opened. I used to know, but 39 anyway, 1939. And then they sent him to Hollywood with the film when they made it into a movie. And it was in Hollywood where he met my mother, who was cast to play the ingenue in the movie. I'm a really good mix of both my mom and my dad, I think. I think I have my mother's responsibility. You know, she was a list maker and check off the list and get this done and think ahead and very responsible. And I'm like that too, to a fault. And but I have my dad's joie de vivre, you know, which is the French word for Cuban fun. He always just had a love of life and a great sense of humor, twisted sense of humor. And his music. I have a lot of music in my life, and I sort of turned to that later in life. And he had a great business sense. I think I'm a pretty good business person, actually, because I think like he does. You know, if you don't know, ask. And there are no stupid questions. Hire the right people and let them do their job. He used to also say, if you don't know what to do, don't do anything, which sounds ridiculous, but it's actually served me very well in my life. He was very practical in that sense, and a great lover of life and everything it had to offer.
But what I want to say out about that is from that, I learned when all these movie stars and all came in, and this was the movie stars at that time were different than ours. They could have had three or four marriages and stuff like that, but the judges had sent these people and tell them they had to go. Baby Frankie had to go with his mother, and even though she'd married somebody else, they had made him go to a place for having some schooling or having some learnings and not learnings as education, but learning of how they can work with the families that they have. The families can work together. Does that make any sense at all? And anyway, so I had become a very good bartender after that, and so they gave me the bartend upstairs for luncheon, and the movie stars and all would come in at the lunchtime and all, and the children would be there, and a lot of them would come over, and we became friends and all, and several of the wealthy people would come over, and you know, a $5 tip or $10 tip was nothing to them, and you got that if you've been nice. So I used some of my time to be with those people, and when I finally left after that first year, they'd all, about 20 of them, had invited me to come to California. Mm-hmm. And I did. For about a month, I went from door to door to these people that had been nice. Now, I was on my way back to the military. I was in the Army. I had to come back at time, but I had some time. So I went and met with a lot of those people, and the Schlumberger family. I don't know if the Schlumberger family is one of the wealthiest in the world and one of the finest in oil people and all. And I got to be really good friends with them because they were wealthy and stayed a long time. But while we were there, I met people from a lot of those thousands of guys and the ladies. And we would, at times, we could get off and we could go under the waterfalls and all that nobody else could go to and all. And they'd be hollering and looking down, and we'd be down there hollering and screaming and having a good time looking up at them. And it was just a great times. And we would go over and meet a lot of people, but there were thousands of people there. You didn't have to go very far to meet them. And I had that room, you know. And so what I decided, I said, listen here, now this is something else. Now I got a bar at night. I got to be at lunch, at dinner, and said, and that room of mine is just sitting there. So I said, you know, so I came up with the idea. I said, look, I'm going to rent that room by the hour. I rented it. You know, the ladies were working there, and they want to go in there and clean, fix their hair or anything like that. So, and the deal was that they put a dollar down, cleaned the sheets if they had gone, if they'd done anything, the sheets and everything clear. I made more money in the shower on the dollar than I was at the bar. But anyway, so I decided that, you know, if I can do these things and those guys can do that thing, I can do something too. And that was the start of my experience. That was my thing. And then when I first got back into the military, and I was first lieutenant only, but they asked me if I wanted to do something, and I said, yeah, I'll do it. So they gave me 31 Cuban people, Cuban military, mm-hmm. and I was supposed to train that crowd.
Can I, let's, for perspective, what was going on with the military at that time? Were we in a war? Or?
Well, no. We were not in a war. We were in
the Cuban crisis.
Cuban crisis when
Castro.
Batista was the president. Mm-hmm. Batista got sent the people to Columbia, South Carolina, and I was the first lieutenant. And the general there was a guy by the name of Loris R. Cochran. That was the general, Loris, and he liked me because I lived in Loris. So we got to be friends. The general, so we got to be friends. So I was given.
Were you at Fort Jackson?
Yeah, oh, Fort Jackson. I was given the looking after. Now, you know, I went. I was. Just, I had to. I, 5 o'clock in the morning. I had to be up there with them. And so I didn't get. But anyway, the Batista and sent them, and we were training them, and. And what was the president's name
Castro.
Castro was coming in at that time. Badly.
He was the rebel.
That's right. Well, Castro was a rebel. So after about 2 or 3 months on a Sunday, we had to work out on Sunday. I got up Sunday. They were all gone.
All of them
had gone out of Fort Jackson. And so I called the general and said, because I had
two star sergeants that were with me, and so we didn't know what was happening, and we thought, you know, we went to where they were supposed to be and all, and nobody was there.
And you were responsible for training them?
I was a trainer. No, I was responsible for training because of Lois R. Cochran. I didn't have enough sense to be, but till Lois R. Cochran had the guy from Lois. We tickle about that all the time. But I got worried about that, and I called him and told him, and we started looking, and we sent airplanes out, we sent boats out, and we never found them, and they had gone into the other group. They left it. And so me being worried and nervous about it, I said, well, General, I said, let's go and turn them in and make them come back. They're our people. We got to, they can't just walk off and leave us.
So they just kind of disappeared from Fort Jackson, and y'all didn't know why.
No. We knew why, because we were training for Batista. We knew that he was there, but we
so he
thought
he called them back.
He thought Batista sent them to us, and the government in America said that we could. We thought that we could train them enough that they would be good soldiers because they were running out of people. So when that day came along, and AWOL is what it was called, AWOL, they were gone, and so I called him, and he said, "Well, go ahead and have the secretary, somebody, fix up let's go after them." So we sent planes and everything like that. But the story, the fun thing, not fun thing, the strange thing is, I had done a lot of work on it and sent people everywhere and calling around everywhere we could find out and sending other people from Georgia or other places out there to look as well. And we never got anything. And I told the general, let me take a group and go looking for them in Cuba. And he said no, but shortly right after that same very day, the United States government called and said, "Don't do anything, let them go." Kind of irritated me.
Yeah.
Because we were there, and Batista had done that, and that.
So they were back in Cuba.
They were back in Cuba, and later on in the years, it seemed like I think I found out two or three of them that had been there, that were still alive, and I'd gone to Cuba a good bit, and this one guy told me that he worked for me when he was there, but about everybody else got killed. It was a terrible thing.
Do you think they went back to support Batista?
No, no, no,
Castro?
No, 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 they were for Castro. Castro, no, they were they were for Castro. 100%.
So they went back to join the revolution.
Yes, they did. That they did, and I got caught up in that, but
that's interesting.
And Lois R. Cochran gave me a Class 6 award for being there. And he should have put me by 2 for letting him get away. But I promise that was a scary thing for me because that was my job, first job I'd had to do anything in the military. So I my military life after that has been made. I left it. From that, and I was
How many years did you serve in Fort Jackson?
90 days.
Okay.
90 days. It was supposed to be 6 months, if you remember the time. And it was 6 months, and I'd even gone to jump school.
Well, now, were you called up especially because of the Cuban Missile Crisis? Is that what?
No,
happened?
It was called. It wasn't that. It was just we had too many people at a time, and you only had 90 days. No, we had 90 days. If they didn't need X people by that time, they would cut them back away from like 2 years like they were planning on to 90 days. I got caught in the 90 days, and I really didn't mind it at all at the time, but that was what that was for. But after that, I've been to Cuba a good number of times and have had some friends there, and it's a nice place, seemingly, most of the time. The Japanese and all have had some great places there. I didn't mean to get way off track on that, but my Yellowstone National Park gave me the courage, gave me the fact that here, a guy that his best thing he can do is drop a watermelon so it'll burst in the right way. Mm-hmm. And here I had a chance at these movie stars and all, and it was, and I cracked my said I could do it,
I knew I could do it.
All right, so now, so after that summer in Yellowstone and in California, you come on back to Horry County. Is that right?
I did, and I immediately went to law school.
Thank you for listening to Bridging the Political Gap. If you've liked what you've heard, please share it. And we would love to hear from you and your thoughts on our show. So if you'd like to, please leave a review wherever you get your podcast. And until next time, thanks again, and so long for now.